We're spending the hour on solutions, what communities have done well, what has gone right in the pandemic. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you can be here. So hearing what others are doing can help us feel less alone, less devastated. Sharing successes spreads examples that otherwise might go unnoticed, right? When we share challenges, it shines a light on where resources may be needed most urgently. What is your success story of this pandemic? What can we learn from you, whether it's an individual family, whether it's a community, an organization? What messages have stuck with you that's encouraged you to take steps in containing the spread? 800-642-1234. Tucker Doherty covers healthcare for Politico. He's looked into which states have done the best job in battling the pandemic. Tucker, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you and your colleagues set out to find which states have done the best in fighting the pandemic. How did you decide how to measure this?
Well, at first we were given an assignment to sort of try to find a way to make a scorecard or find objective measures, whether it was the number of cases or how many deaths there were. We quickly realized while talking with each other and talking with experts that every state is really unique in terms of when the pandemic hit and, you know, its geography, its population, its economy. So it wasn't so easy to compare directly. So what we ended up doing instead is we talked to dozens and dozens of experts around the country, in academia, public officials, and so forth, and sort of looked for an expert consensus on which states appeared to be doing best and which ones were really seen as role models widely. And when we talked to all those experts, there were definitely a few states that stood out.
Yeah, so you were probably looking for common threads, some of those aha moments as well, I would imagine.
Yes. And there was definitely a little bit of sort of validating conventional wisdom about it and also a few surprising things.
So Vermont stood out as doing one of the best jobs anywhere in the country with the lowest number of deaths per capita. Why did Vermont stand out to you?
I think Vermont shows that it's both the top-down nature in terms of what the state government and what local leaders are doing that matters, but it's also bottom-up. You have to have people in agreement, people taking this seriously, and you need cooperation sort of from, you know, give and take on both sides of that. So, for example, Vermont, on the one hand, was relatively strict with how much it restricted travel. If you were in a state that had a lot of transmission and came to Vermont or returned home to Vermont, they asked you to quarantine for 2 weeks. On the other hand, they recognized that asking someone to quarantine for 2 weeks is a big ask. So they came up with resources for people who are doing that. And they also came up with a way.
Wait, when you say resources, what do you mean?
You know, whether it's food deliveries, you know, making sure you have everything that you need, making sure that if you were out of a job during that time, that you had unemployment support, things of that nature. But I guess, you know, getting back to the point, though, you know, there was this 14-day period you would be asked to isolate, but you could get out of it early with a negative test. And for a lot of people, you know, they found that made them more willing to comply in the first place. And I think that was one of the big lessons is that, you know, if you're too strict and you don't give people any room to sort of find a reasonable compromise, you might end up getting nothing at all. Now, sort of the other side of that is the role of partisanship, which I think is something could certainly use a national lesson in. Vermont has a moderate Republican governor and a very Democratic legislature. And so in a lot of states, that's been a recipe for disagreement and discord. But in Vermont, just because they were able to work together so effectively, it ended up establishing a lot of community trust. And when there's more trust, it means people are more willing to actually follow these public health measures.
We're talking with Tucker Doherty, who's a healthcare reporter for Politico. He's been looking into how states have been successful in fighting the spread of COVID. What tactics have you heard about in other countries or states taking the fight against the pandemic and actually turning it around? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Mary Kay now in Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay.
Good morning. First, we should have tests available like at CVS, Walgreens, Walmart for people that are ill. As soon as they're feeling ill and they've talked to their doctor, they should be able to go purchase a test and take the test at home. The second thing is do the three W's. Wear a mask, wash your hands frequently, and watch your distance. The next one is keep clean, keep your clothing clean and your home clean. And people that don't comply, we have to get the point across that we're all in this together, okay? It won't work if we're not all doing the same thing. And the sixth thing is stop travel from countries that are high in the corona right now. Then they'll be forced to do what we're already doing.
Mary Kay, thank you for that. And so, Tucker, you know, Mary Kay brings up a number of points. One is we're all in this together. And as you were saying there, that really matters to make sure that people are on the same page, whether it's the public health experts, whether it's local residents or people in the government.
Right. And I think that is definitely one of the most powerful messages. And I think what you find is that when everyone is on the same page and everyone recognizes that this is a communal problem, everyone sort of ends up getting more of what they want. So another concern that people have with restrictions, with lockdowns and all that is the economy. What's that going to do to local small businesses? And that, you know, that's a valid concern. A lot of people are looking at their livelihoods at risk. And another reason we thought Vermont was such an interesting example is that they did well on both fronts. They managed to have low cases and low deaths and contain the virus. And therefore, because of that, they ended up having much less fear of people, you know, when they needed to shop or when they you know, needed to get groceries, things like that. So they also ended up having one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country. So I think, you know, when you recognize that this is something where everyone's in it together, whether you're someone who's at risk or whether you're a business owner or just an everyday person, you can sort of have your cake and eat it too, to some extent, if you can get everyone working together.
I want to take a look here. New York and Washington, two of the states hit first by the pandemic, but your reporting found that Washington State did a better job of controlling the pandemic. Why did Washington fare better than New York?
So I think, you know, there are a lot of random factors. It's especially early on, it's difficult to tell exactly, you know, who was hit how early and so forth. That being said, there were a couple common threads that came up when we would ask experts, you know, why did Seattle and New York City see such different fates? And I think the number one thing I heard about the early response was you know, how disciplined the public health messaging was in Washington State. And one of the big things they did is they let their public health officials lead. So when the governor would hold a press conference in Washington very early on, you know, the governor would say, "Hey, I'm not a health expert. So I'm going to step aside to the podium and you know, let this expert tell you what's safe and what's not safe." Whereas in New York and New York City and New York State, there was a lot more mixed messaging early on. There was sort of a lot of feuding between the mayor and the governor and between, you know, local politicians and state politicians and so forth. And so during that key period of sort of early to late March, where some people heard mixed messages in New York saying, "If you're healthy, still go out." In Seattle, they definitely heard a unified voice from the public health authorities.
Tucker Daugherty covers healthcare for Politico. We're talking about role models, community states that have effectively deployed public health measures to contain the spread. 800-642-1234. What is your pandemic success story? We'll be back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're looking at strategies that have helped states, cities, towns, villages contain the spread of COVID. It's a conversation about what seems to work well here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. South Korea's aggressive virus response had become a model for the world, but a fresh cycle of pandemic infections after relaxing rules shows that relapse is real. Did your community or organization get early buy-in on testing? Did you watch a particular country respond? What can you tell us? 800-642-1234 on Lessons Learned. Tucker Dougherty covers healthcare for Politico, and he's our guide. Tucker, you're reporting, you reported efforts of our neighbor Michigan to bring the racial disparities of the pandemic to the forefront. What did you find there in Michigan?
So I think Michigan is a story of not getting it right at first but making a strong pivot and dealing with problems as they crop up. So as a lot of people are aware, the coronavirus pandemic has not hit all communities equally. Black Americans in particular have been hit very hard. They have higher case rates, higher death rates. And that was particularly true at the beginning of the pandemic when the initial wave was sort of hitting urban communities hardest. So in Michigan in particular, Detroit was hit hard very early on, and it led to sort of a very disproportionate toll. I believe Black residents are something like 16 or 17% of the state, and they were comprising over half of the deaths at one point. So when they realized that was going on and sort of how horrifying that was, they didn't just resolve that this was a long-term issue, that this is something that would eventually be addressed. They set up a task force and they got, important, visible figures involved in it, like the lieutenant governor. And what they focused on was, what are the concrete actions they could take immediately that would actually address this? A few examples. A lot of states early on set up drive-in testing sites. I don't know if you've ever gotten a drive-in COVID test, but it's very convenient. They can just come right up to your window and don't have to worry about setting up so many tents and so forth. But there's an equity problem with that, and that's not everyone has a car. Mm-hmm. And there are entire neighborhoods and entire areas where very few people have a car. And it turns out that the people who tend not to have it might be the people who get overlooked. It might be people in working class neighborhoods, in sort of traditionally African American neighborhoods. So they had a big focus early on, and other states learned from them that you can get a lot of extra benefits by setting up walk-in testing sites, and that you get a different group of people into those kind of sites.
Yeah.
Right. And sort of also making sure you set those up in areas that don't have, so many hospitals or so many CVSs, and paying attention to what local resources there are. And then in all sorts of other ways, looking at marginalized populations, people who get overlooked. They were one of the most aggressive early states to tackle testing COVID in their prison and jail populations. And I think there's really a lesson there in that there are these parts of our society that can get overlooked or that you can forget. But when you have an infectious disease that affects everybody, it's in everybody's interest to make sure you're not leaving people behind. And Michigan, to its credit, in the months since, has essentially seen that racial disparity closed. Mm.
Wow. So being proactive on issues of equity. Tucker Dougherty covers healthcare for Politico. We're looking at how some states succeeded in some aspects of battling this pandemic. We're finding those success threads. Hearing from you as well, 800-642-1234. Ray is with us in Janesville. Hi, Ray.
Good morning to you, Kate.
Good morning.
Hey, I'm just curious on where Wisconsin stands, because our governor tries to do the right thing, but Republican legislators argue with him about everything. And with going into stores like Bernard's, you don't walk in without a mask because they'll throw you out. And it used to be like that at Walmart, but I was there 2 days ago at Walmart. People in the checkout were not wearing a mask. And if you go into a gas station, only half the people wear a mask. I mean, I just don't know how we can get anywhere with everyone. Everybody won't do the right thing together.
Ray, thank you for that. So Ray observing very uneven mask wearing and wonders, where does Wisconsin stand in what you found, Tucker?
I think Wisconsin is a state, sort of as alluded to there, it's a state where the politics have to some degree gotten in the way a bit, that it is something that, like much of the country, it's become somewhat of a polarized issue, you know, where something like mask wearing, that in a lot of countries and in some of the more successful areas, it is seen as a common sense measure. It becomes more contentious, and it becomes something people fight each other about and people shame each other about. And I think on the one hand, you can have a lot of sympathy if you're someone who, like me, who believes that masks work and that masks are important, you know, especially in public spaces. And I think when you look at success stories, you know, there's no success story where people just yelled at each other until things got fixed. Really, you know, like we said with Vermont, you really need to find some way to get people's cooperation to, you know, make everyone see themselves as all part of the same team. And I think that's just an area where, you know, in some states, you know, Michigan included, where there's still been a lot of contention, between the partisan sides.
Well, let's stay in the heartland for a moment here. Go to Iowa, sure. Because Iowa got high marks in your report for doing a good job of getting unemployment checks to residents. What went right in Iowa?
Right. Iowa and Minnesota are both states that we highlighted for their unemployment system. And I think with them, a lot of it was just having a modernized system. Mm. You know, it was something they had set up before the pandemic. So this wasn't something they had, you know, thrown together at the last minute. And basically, you know, a lot of states, when they think about unemployment benefits, their first thought is, you know, too many people will get it, or there will be fraud. You know, so the systems are designed to be sort of very deliberative, to have lots of checks and steps. And frankly, a lot of them are outdated. It's not something a lot of state governments want to invest in, you know, sort of just computerizing and all of that. But a few states did have computerized unemployment insurance systems, and, you know, they did have these databases. And so when there was this grand emergency, when suddenly you had all of these checks and you had unprecedented unemployment, some states were able to process that very quickly. And so when in April people were, you know, millions of people were out of a job, some states were able to get the money to their residents quickly, while at the same time, because they had modernized their system and made it a lot easier for their state officials to navigate, they were also able to combat fraud more easily. So, you know, there's some of these states, Iowa in particular, they have not received high marks on necessarily containing the virus or preventing deaths. But just because you might struggle in one area doesn't mean you can't shine in another. And so we thought that Iowa's you know, very responsive approach to the economic catastrophe was something that experts recognized.
Something remarkable there. You know, what we're hearing is states all have their own different approaches to this pandemic. Would a single national response, even if it were imperfect, would that have been a better way to approach this pandemic?
I think when we talked to experts, essentially every single one thought, yes, a national response that was more coordinative would have helped. But it's a matter of, you know, what will be national, what will be coordinated, and what will be left local. You know, when it comes to sort of some of the harshest parts of lockdown, like shutting down businesses or ordering people to stay in their homes, that is something where a lot of it depends on local conditions. So you might want to leave that to a mayor or a governor. On the other hand, when it comes to what public health messages you're giving people, what advice you're telling them, giving them information about the virus, and again, returning to this theme of partisanship and making sure everyone sees themselves as on the same team, those are areas where the experts really thought our country could have done better to have a national message and a national plan in place. And I think that's again, where various states, whether it's Washington or Vermont or Iowa, There are things that our national leaders can learn from success at the state and local level.
Oh, yeah. So you could cherry pick and then bring together all of those solutions to build a national model.
Exactly.
Tucker, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tucker Daugherty covers healthcare for Politico. We're discussing strategies to contain the spread all hour long in communities that have been successful on certain aspects of this pandemic, as we've been hearing. We get lessons from the Cherokee Nation next. Where in the world have you seen leadership and bold action to stop COVID? Is it working now? 800-642-1234. We'll be back after a news update. More lessons learned so far from COVID here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we talk about role models, early adopters of aggressive public health measures to contain the spread of COVID. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Cherokee Nation is one of those role models with about 140,000 citizens in northeastern Oklahoma. Its actions have met the approval of global health leaders, and now it's receiving hundreds of the first doses of the vaccine this week. That's according to Indian Country Today. What have been some of the success stories in the pandemic? Where do you see a strong response? And what are the measures that have worked to keep residents safe? It's 800-642-1234. Brian Hale is Deputy Executive Director of External Operations at Cherokee Nation Health Services. Prior to that, he was the CEO of Hastings Hospital, which is run by the tribe. Brian, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, and thank you.
When did the Cherokee Nation, take us back to the early days here of the pandemic, when did the Cherokee Nation first start paying attention to the pandemic?
I would say January 30th of 2020. We started initiating travel screening for staff and then kept watching it. We kind of kept in touch with our infectious disease physician and our epidemiology folks and asking them, you know, is this something we need to be paying attention to? It quickly became obvious that it was going to be something that, would eventually affect us. And so February 28th, we started having some discussions on the risk. And then on March 2nd, we activated our COVID-19 task force and started meeting daily.
Daily. What were those meetings like early on each day?
Well, looking back, you know, we all gathered around a table together and would meet. And looking back, if we'd known then what we knew pretty quickly, we probably wouldn't have met in person together like that. We very quickly, started splitting our teams up and learning to use Zoom and other virtual conferencing methods. And then on March 6th, we had the first case in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. That's the day we established a COVID-19 hotline and then started getting situation updates with the Oklahoma State Department of Health. And then March 16th, I feel like we really kind of led the way being aggressive on this. Chief Hoskin issued a shelter-in-place directive, and we started having mask mandates in facilities.
What were tribal elders telling you?
That they were scared, and that the other concern is, we don't have a lot of people that speak Cherokee as a first language anymore. And because of the way that COVID targeted elders, we really felt this motivation to keep them safe, to keep them at home. So we did a food distribution as a tribe, taking them food so they didn't have to get out, providing them with masks, providing them with the resources that they need. We actually did some cash distribution so that people could, pay their utility bills. This is an area of the country, and then, even within a poor state, this area is economically challenged. And so, we're rural. The economy, even during good times, is never great. We're very much dependent on, oil and gas prices.
Yeah.
So we did everything that we could to support them, socioeconomically. And very quickly, said, hey, non-essential service lines are going to be reduced to acute care only, and did everything that we could for telehealth to make that a big part of our service.
Telehealth, one of the areas certainly we've struggled with here is broadband, access to the internet at a speed that can deliver what you need to do. Has broadband access been an issue where you are?
Very much so. And some of the telehealth rules require you to have a video component. And so that's been a challenge in a lot of our areas because exactly what you said, there's not penetration of broadband. You don't have great penetration of smartphone coverage. Or if you do have a smartphone, you don't have the...
I think we just lost you there for a moment. Brian, are you still there? Brian, I'm sorry. We lost you there just for a moment. Carry on. You were talking about smartphones as well.
Okay, so penetration of smartphones and broadband is a challenge, and so having those telehealth calls with the video component is definitely something that we've had to work on. That's also a reason why it's important for us to keep our kids in school as much as we can. So at the Sequoia High School, which is a education program that we operate as a tribe, we in October, as soon as we started getting access to some of the antigen tests, started testing the teachers, testing the students so that we can continue having in-person classes at least one day a week for each grade, and actually taught the teachers to do the test themselves. And so now that's a sustaining operation where the staff do all the testing each week.
How is that going, and how often are students in school? What is that set up like?
So the freshmen go on Mondays,
Okay. Yeah,
sophomores go on Tuesdays, juniors on Wednesdays, and seniors on Thursdays, and they're actually in class on those days. Outside of that, it's all virtual, but they do get to class one day a week, and then they're also, I believe they give them a backpack with some food and snacks for the rest of the week, but we test them that morning before they go into class, and, you know, we made clear that the idea was not to make sure there's no COVID cases at all, but to stop an outbreak, and I think it's been very successful with that. We also test the staff once a week as well.
We're talking with Brian Hale, Deputy Executive Director of External Operations at Cherokee Nation Health Services. We're looking for those success stories, lessons learned in battling this pandemic. Taking your insights as well, what measures do you wish that Wisconsin had taken during the pandemic? What can we learn from our mistakes and how we've dealt with the pandemic to date? 800-642-1234 to join in. Brian, the Cherokee Nation started doing contact tracing in March, I understand. What has that effort involved?
A lot of people on the phone, and basically they act as almost private investigators, and you know, and I don't know how people are in Wisconsin, but I can tell you around here they don't like answering questions about where they've been and who they've talked to, and so that's definitely been a challenge. And so you have to be half private investigator, half diplomat. And so it's been really important to us to make sure that we have people on the phone doing the case investigation, doing the contact tracing, that have empathy, that have good phone skills, and that understand how the disease acts. And so who needs to be quarantined, who needs to be isolated. So as we closed down some of our non-essential services, we actually took those staff and quickly trained them so they could pivot and start working as contact tracers and case investigators. And not everyone can do that. We've even found that a lot of our, you know, nursing staff and healthcare professionals, they're not great on the phone as contact tracers and case investigators because maybe they just don't have the phone skills that they need to and the ability to relate to some of the people that we're making contact with.
I was going to ask you there about trying to build that workforce, having enough contact tracers, because that too has been such a challenge. Do you have enough?
I think we are getting to the point. It's taken us a while, but we are kind of learning how many contacts each person can make per day, how many case investigations someone can take on per day. And so that allows us to say, hey, if we've got this many cases, we're going to need this many folks on the phones doing the contact tracing. And so we're getting better at kind of gauging that, having some ways to benchmark our staff. And what I will say, though, is I don't know if there's ever enough contact tracer when you're in a surge. There are days when the staff, they start at 7 in the morning, and we have a very committed staff of contact tracers and case investigators, and they won't leave till everyone at least gets that initial contact. So sometimes they're here till 9 or 10 o'clock at night.
Oh, wow. When it comes to masks, mask wearing, when did the Cherokee Nation put in a mask mandate, and how is that going?
So we implemented a mask mandate officially within Cherokee Nation in May. Before that, many of the health facilities had kind of started doing it, and then we had a mandate from Chief Hoskin in May. And I would say as far as on Cherokee Nation properties, the health facilities, the casinos and places like that, it's working very well. And we really, I don't know that we've seen any cases of transmission at work, you know, with the mask mandate. But Cherokee Nation is within the larger community, and I would say that the larger community here in Northeast Oklahoma has not maybe been as dedicated to
vigilant.
The mask mandate
yeah.
as we would like to see.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we see that here, too, that, you know, some parts of our communities, masks are pervasive. Everyone's wearing them. And then you go someplace else or into a different area, and it's not so quite uneven. And I'm just wondering how you've been able to get out that message that you really do need to wear your mask in public.
So we've tried to have a united, consistent, repeated message about everything ranging from the mask mandate to hand hygiene to social distancing, and now focusing on the vaccine, making sure that people understand it's safe, it's effective, and that even once we have the vaccine, that, you know, the masks don't go away right away. So we've used social media. We have used video messages from our chief and from our physician leaders. We've gone to meetings in, you know, in town, things like that. We've tried to do everything that we can to make sure people get the message about the masks, and we've tried to model good behavior. But it's been an uphill battle, but I think it's been worth it, and I think we've had some success. I shudder to think what kind of situation we would be in had we not at least tried.
Yeah. I'm wondering, how have Cherokee Nation leaders been able to get the messages across? Do you feel that there is a cohesive message to citizens?
So one of the biggest messages that we've kind of tried to use is we're protecting our elders. And because we have so few Cherokee speakers left, it's really important to protect those elders. And so that's been kind of the primary message that we've had around masks, is that it protects you, it protects the elders, it protects your family.
And I think that probably is a singular message. You don't even need more than that. I mean, that is truly important.
Right. We try to stay out of some of the debates about whether or not they work. And one of the things that I've, you know, said is, let's say they don't work. What's the harm?
Yeah. Yeah. Brian Hale is Deputy Executive Director of External Operations at Cherokee Nation Health Services. We're talking about pandemic wins this hour, the successes that happened in groups of people who worked together to contain the spread. What tactics have you heard about other countries, other states taking in the fight against the pandemic? What can we learn from our mistakes and how we've dealt with the pandemic? Still time to talk about lessons learned. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Brian Hale here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're sharing stories of success this hour. What's working and what do communities know so far about transmission, about spikes, about waves, testing, contact tracing, resisting COVID fatigue? Who do you hold up as a model for combating COVID? What can we learn from them? 800-642-1234. Brian Hale is Deputy Executive Director of External Operations at Cherokee Nation Health Services, and he's with us for 10 more minutes. Brian, I want to talk about vaccines. I understand that Cherokee Nation has received vaccines. What can you tell us? Did they arrive?
We did, and just very excited about that. We actually got our first shipment in yesterday morning, and then we had been scheduling, you know, people for the vaccination starting this morning, but yesterday afternoon, some of our pharmacists approached us and said they'd really, really like to maybe have a chance to thaw them and dilute at least one vial so we could kind of get some practice with it ahead of the big effort we were going to make this morning. And so yesterday afternoon, we thawed one vial And we gave, actually ended up giving six doses
yesterday. Yeah, one vial is how many doses?
So it's supposed to be five, but there's a little bit of overfill in each vial. And our pharmacists were very meticulous with the way that they diluted it and drew it up. And we actually managed to get six doses out of that one vial. So we hope that continues to be the case. Because, you know, obviously we had a limited allocation of this first vaccine, but we're just really excited about that. We feel like that's the first step in hopefully the last chapter of this pandemic. But we've also tried to manage expectations with everyone to make sure they understand this is not the end, that this is one more layer of defense that we have to add along with the masks and, you know, continuing to have social distancing and everything else that we're doing to keep everyone safe here.
How did you come up with your plan to how the vaccines will be distributed and when they're distributed? How did that plan come together?
So we work closely with Indian Health Service because, you know, we are a tribal health facility, but we have good ties to IHS. And so we have been working with them on the pre-planning phase. And basically what we did is we looked at the playbook from Operation Warp Speed that the CDC and IHS had put out. And we mostly mirrored their phases and their priorities. We did have some tailoring of the priorities because we really wanted to get Cherokee speakers, Cherokee National Treasures, and some of those folks in that first group very quickly, along with obviously healthcare workers in the inpatient settings and our first responders. We operate a ambulance service, so we wanted to get our paramedics and our EMTs vaccinated, as well as our Cherokee Nation Marshal Service.
Have you been able to cover enough in those this initial shipment to get at these groups that you really need to vaccinate first? What do you expect with future shipments ahead?
We have been told to expect ongoing shipments, probably won't be as large as this first one that we got yesterday. I believe we received 975 doses. And so that... we're having a little bit of a challenge with vaccine uptake, and so we've offered it to everyone at the hospital that we operate, and we had done some surveys of staff before this to kind of gauge what the interest is in receiving the vaccine. And so right now we're seeing about a 30% vaccine uptake. We think that will improve as others kind of watch coworkers and just see that, you know, they're going to be okay, that it's a safe vaccine and that the vaccine works. So we think we'll have enough to get everybody that we want to get in that first group as far as our healthcare workers and first responders, and make a start on some of our elders that are also speakers of the Cherokee language.
So 30% uptake initially. Do you anticipate then going back to people who don't want it now to say, have you changed your mind? How will that work?
We have been very clear. One of the things that we've set up is if someone passes on the vaccine, they have to do a quick little educational session and basically say, I understand the risks associated with not taking the vaccine. I don't want the vaccine. And I also understand that I can change my mind and get the vaccine later. And all they have to do is contact their employee health nurse, and we'll make arrangements for them to receive the vaccine.
So at any point, then, they have that opening to be able to get that vaccine. They don't have to wait in order to maybe it will be offered to them again somewhere down the line. If at any point they change their mind, they can get it immediately.
That is our plan. They're also, though, taking a risk that, you know, if we get this one allocation and keep going through different groups and use all of it, then they would have to wait until we receive another allocation of vaccine. But we're confident that we'll continue to receive additional allocations of the vaccine. We know the Moderna vaccine is supposed to receive emergency use authorization soon, and so we're anticipating that one. And we also believe it'll be a little easier to distribute to some of our other facilities because it doesn't have the cold storage requirements like the Pfizer one does.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you have the deep freezing capacity for this Pfizer vaccine? What have you had to do there?
So very early on, when we were hearing that the Pfizer vaccine was the front runner and that the Pfizer vaccine had this ultra cold storage requirement, we started looking to see if we had any of these freezers that would do that. And we had one, but it was used for lab specimens. And you can't put lab specimens and medications in the same freezer together. So we ordered one. Actually, we ordered five, but We only received one so far. We're waiting for the other four to ship, but we do have one. We got it a few weeks ago, got it up to temp and everything, and it is being used as we speak, and that's been a big boon for us as far as us being able to say we can take the vaccine, we can take as much as you want to send us, and also if you want to store it here, you know, for other facilities in the region, feel free to do that as well. So we've told our partners with Oklahoma State Department of Health and IHS that, you know, we're willing to be that regional storage hub for this area, because there's not a lot of places in rural Oklahoma that have a deep freezer that'll go to minus 80 Celsius.
We're talking with Brian Hale, Deputy Executive Director of External Operations. He's at Cherokee Nation Health Services as we explore lessons learned so far in the pandemic, early efforts to contain the spread, and where we're at today with vaccines and the rollout. You can join in 800-642-1234. Brian, how is morale among healthcare workers, among the healthcare workers who are caring for COVID patients?
I would say it's a little better today. The vaccine has definitely been kind of a morale booster around here.
Yeah.
I was up in the hospital over the weekend helping with some staff that had been threatened by a patient. They came in here, actually the family member of a patient, so helping them deal with that. And I would say for the most part, they're doing very well. You know, we've been on alert for a long time, and the surge has definitely hit here now. We've had to expand our ICU as part of our surge plan now, so typically, we have six ICU beds. We've expanded that now to nine, and all nine of those are full with four patients on ventilators. And it's getting tougher and tougher for us to transfer to the metropolitan areas, which would be Tulsa and Oklahoma City. And that's been hard for a while, but it's definitely getting worse. And I don't know that we've ever had this many people on ventilators in our facility before.
Do you have enough nurses and doctors? What is staffing like?
So we have been using a lot of agency staff and relying on our staff to work extra hours. And so that's the challenge is for us is probably not going to be beds and ventilators. The challenge is going to be keeping everything staffed. And so fortunately, a lot of our leadership are clinical. You know, they served in clinical roles before they became administrators and leaders. And so we've all been kind of brushing up on our clinical skills, and we're ready to step into the breach if need be.
Brian, can you leave us with any advice you can leave us with that would help?
Educators, I just hope that people read scientific evidence, that they will look at information objectively and realize that, you know, this isn't our first pandemic. It won't be our last pandemic. And we really need to get through this together, and everyone be smart about it. Wear your mask and take care of each other.
Brian, thank you for joining us. Take care.
Thank you.
Brian Hale is Deputy Executive Director of External Operations for Cherokee Nation Health Services. We reached him in Oklahoma. Just ahead, it is 1A. Early voting is now underway in Georgia, and so much hangs on whether the Democrats can flip two vital Senate seats. Jen White takes the pulse of the Peach State. That's next, 1A. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.